Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust.
Today, it's the JFK Assassination, Part 1, featuring a great talk by Michael Parenti and additional commentary by yours truly, and of course, a little music somewhere in the middle. I hope you'll stay tuned. 45 years ago this week, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated during a motorcade at Dealey Plaza in the city of Dallas, Texas, November 22, 1963. I was 13 at the time, and I remember the event, at least as it was presented on TV. Alas, if you want to get a good sense of what's happening in the world, TV news is a hell of a bad place to start. Who killed Kennedy, and why? According to TV, and confirmed by the corporate press and a big government commission, Kennedy was killed by a disgruntled solitary loner acting independently. Yes, yet another lone gunman. In September, we springboarded, we sprang from the USS Liberty incident to a review of at least many of the alleged misfits and sad sacks who have made up the American treasure trove of lone gunmen acting independently. There is a long line of these LGs, starting with John Wilkes Booth and continuing to this very day, the latest being Dr. Bruce Ivins, late of the U.S. Army Germ Bomb Center of Excellence at Fort Meade, Maryland. A hard-drinking, solitary loner who liked pornography, and, if you can believe the press, who had a thing for sorority sisters of Kappa Kappa Gamma. Can't you just picture those nymphs of loveliness? Blonde hair, which may be real or bottled, only their hairdresser knows for sure, for they've substituted a discreet lower abdominal tattoo for all body hair below the eyebrows. Maybe also a discreet mural tattoo just above the buttocks. Chains of Celtic knots are fashionable this season, though of course the art history majors would choose something more playful and provocative. Da Vinci's The Last Supper, say, or Picasso's Guernica, or something fanciful from Picabia. Here's my fearless prediction. The next hot trend in tattoo body art? Old Coca-Cola magazine advertisements. Tell your daughter, if you're lucky enough to have one. After Ivins's alleged suicide, the FBI leaked a whole shipload of odd details. Details proving that the late Dr. Ivins was a creep, and therefore a mass murderer. And, as always, the media sucked it all up, then sprayed it all over to us, unchanged and unquestioned. Ivins liked to look at pornography. Ivins was a heavy drinker. Ivins had a lifelong fetish for Kappa Kappa Gamma girls. Geez, if these details are that scary, how come no one reduced Ivins's ultra-top-secret security clearance? In fact, friends of long standing state that they haven't heard Ivins mention Kappa Kappa Gamma for at least 30 years. But let's not spoil the story. Because, you see, that's why some letters with live anthrax were mailed from a letterbox in New Jersey at the campus of Princeton University. Because of Ivins's Kappa fetish, he drove an envelope full of weapons-grade anthrax spores from his home in Maryland up to Princeton University so he could be near the Kappas when he mailed the anthrax. He was mailing the anthrax for and on behalf of the Kappa sisters, tattooed or not, because the mailbox is just 100 yards away from the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority house. You see, he's guilty. And as the pretty boy reading the teleprompter on the dim witness evening news is wont to say, that should put to rest any lingering doubts. And thank God for that, Kyle, says the pretty woman reading the same teleprompter. Meanwhile, in local news, Paris Hilton drove through town today, stopping briefly at the Dunkin' Donuts by exit 43. Here's reporter Susie Cream Cheese, live from Dunkin' Donuts. How much do most Americans know about the campus of Princeton University? How many Americans could even tell you what town it's in? All they know is that F. Scott Fitzgerald and Albert Einstein teach there. And once a year, probably in late fall, the college plays a football game against Harvard. Americans know as much about Princeton as they know about cop killer bullets, or Palestine, or the Franco-Prussian War. Zilch, or pretty close to it. How many Americans know that there is no Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority house at Princeton University? Gee, you mean Dr. Ivins took that long car trip to mail the anthrax for nothing? No, 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 Kyle, wake up and smell the fertilizer in yon cow pasture. But to answer your question, according to the press and TV and the official government report, the Warren Commission report it's called, named after Commission Chairman Chief Justice Earl Warren. Don't you remember all those impeach Earl Warren billboards? Amazingly, those went up years before he gave birth to the Kennedy assassination report, not immediately afterwards. But to answer your question, according to official government no conspiracy here theory, Kennedy was shot by a disturbed and disgruntled lone gunman named Lee Harvey Oswald from an upper story window of a warehouse for school books using a Carcano, some say Mannlicher Carcano, military rifle, Italian Army surplus, with a single bullet that performed mid-air trajectory surprises unlike any rifle bullet seen before or since, with sights that were hopelessly out of adjustment. The Italians remember the Carcano fondly. They gave it this affectionate epithet, the gun that never killed a man intentionally. The perfect gun for Oswald, by all accounts, if he were lying on the floor inside a barn with a rifle in his hands. He couldn't hit the roof, let alone the broadside of the barn. Kids, don't try this at home. In sum, the crap they're pulling now with the late Dr. Ivins is the same crap they pulled in 1963 with the late President Kennedy and the late Mr. Lee Harvey Oswald. And did somebody just say 9/11? We didn't know this in 1963, of course. We took the word of statesmen at close to face value, and we didn't shelve weighty Federal Commission reports in the fiction section. And no American leader had been assassinated since McKinley was shot. By a disgruntled lone gunman, incidentally. Anyway, I bought the whole official fairy tale. In my defense, I was 13 at the time. On the 30th anniversary of Kennedy's murder, 15 years ago, activist and political scientist Michael Parenti gave a wonderful lecture titled The JFK Assassination and the Gangster Nature of the State. I'm going to play selections from it this week and next. I've discussed the government's case against the latest lone gunman, Dr. Bruce Ivins. Now we'll hear Parenti hilariously explaining the government's case against the first lone gunman of his life and mine, Lee Harvey Oswald. First, let's take a break and hear some period music. If the Beach Boys of that period were alive and on speaking terms today, here's what they'd sing.
A lot going on in the Middle East. An illegal invasion, one more planned at least. Homeland security is a joke. The war on terror's gonna leave us broke. The country's headed down the road to ruin. But let's go do what all the kids are doing, waterboarding. So grab your boards and come on round. Grab the nearest guy that's brown. Tie him up and hose him down. We're gonna make him think he'll drown. It used to be inhuman and cruel, but the Attorney General says it's really cool. Waterboarding. They're waxing up the boards out at Abu Ghraib. Hey, waterboarding. And Guantanamo Bay's gonna catch the wave. There's other places I could tell you about. Hey, waterboarding. But the border in chief won't let the secret out. Hey, waterboarding. It's not like that many people are dying. And
Imagine if we were really trying waterboarding. So raise his feet up above his head, put a towel on his face, cover up the dread. Pour water on it till he thinks he's dead, and be sure to write down anything he said. You'll say what you want, but that only shows you were right in your suspicion about what he knows. Waterboarding. Now the detainees are really scum. Bush said bring it on, and they had to come. We'll never understand why they're so mean, but we sure know how to make them come clean. They hate our freedoms, well that's okay. Hey, waterboarding. 'Cause we weren't gonna give them to them anyway. And don't let the apologists make a fuss. Hey, waterboarding. 'Cause the terrorists wouldn't dare do it to us. Hey, waterboarding. Let's make the detainees feel involved. And if they really drown, well, problem solved. Who cares if democracy is dissolved? Waterboarding. So we'll take away your rights in the name of fear. We'll forget about it within a year. You know it can never happen here unless we think you're liberal, Muslim, or queer. You've nothing to worry about unless you try to make a telephone call or take an airplane ride. Or if we think there's a place we can safely hide, waterboarding. America's finally come undone. Looks like the terrorists finally won. And the biggest is the son of 41. Waterboarding. 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 Hope you bought a warden. Waterboarding.
You are listening to New World Notes, special program on the Kennedy assassination, part one. Here's Michael Parenti.
What are we trying to say? That along with government, we also have a thing called a state. And along with governance, along with policies, and along with those things, we have this other instrument, even in a democratic state. And that instrument, whether it's in democratic France, or democratic England, or democratic Germany, or democratic Italy, or democratic USA, or democratic Canada, and all these countries, all of them have these other instruments and agencies that act like a bunch of gangsters, that act repressively, that use surveillance, that use every dirty trick in the book, unequal enforcement of tax laws, name it. The bringing in of drugs into whole neighborhoods and communities, trumped up murder charges, assassination. And that you have in the middle of these democracies, you have the state within the state known as the national security state. And that state is capable of the most unspeakable crimes that you can think of. And those crimes are perpetrated against their own people. They're perpetrated against people all around the world. Let's start with Oswald. If you watch television this week, you again, for the 78th time, heard that Oswald was a loner, an incompetent, not very bright. You heard he was emotionally disturbed. Gerald Posner got on there, turning instant psychiatrist, and he said, Lee Harvey Oswald was a very disturbed young boy. He had a very disturbed childhood, and he was a passive aggressive. I said, a passive aggressive? A passive-aggressive assassin? How does that work? That explains why he used a rifle which couldn't shoot straight. He also was a leftist. Alexander Coburn has joined the right and the center, and in a column in the Examiner said he was a leftist. The truth is something else. Lee Harvey Oswald, all his IQ tests show that he was above average intelligence. He was a bright guy, a quick learner. Lee Harvey Oswald spent most of his adult life not as a lonely drifter, but directly linked to the U.S. intelligence community. At the age of 18 in the U.S. Marines, he had secret security clearance, and he was working at Marine Air Control in Atsugi Base in Japan. Atsugi was a top secret base where the CIA launched some of its U-2 flights and did other kinds of covert operations in China. The next year, at the age of 19, he was assigned to El Toro Air Station in California with security clearance to work radar. And here he emerged, certain strange things began to happen. He emerged as a babbling Russophile and Soviet communist. He started playing Russian language records at blast level in his barracks. He started addressing his fellow Marines in Russian. He read Russian books and touted Soviet communism as, quote, the best system in the world. He called his fellow Marines comrades. Now, the U.S. Marine Corps in 1958 was not exactly known as a bastion of liberal tolerance and free thinking. My buddy Bernard Livingston wrote a book called Closet Red. He tells of his experiences in the Army where they had to filter out anybody who had funny opinions, who had pinko-ish opinions or whatever else, they had to be reported. That the Army constantly, and I'm sure the Marines, constantly surveils anybody who might outspokenly or actively begin to say or act certainly in the way he did. But in this instance, Oswald's Marine commanders didn't mind. He kept his security clearance. He kept all the radar records. He could see what was going in and out and knew all about the things that were happening there. And he, a wealth of sensitive radar information and other highly sensitive information from sensitive bases, black operations as they were called. Well, if Oswald was a Soviet spy or a Cuban spy, as some people now claim, he certainly had a novel way of building a cover. Other odd things began happening. In February 1959, Lee Harvey Oswald failed the Marine Corps proficiency test in Russian. 6 months later, he was practically fluent in Russian. Only in 1974, a document that was dislodged from the Warren Commission that had been secreted thanks to Howard Weisberg's legal efforts got the document out. It was shown that Oswald had attended the U.S. Army Monterey School of Languages. Now, Monterey is not open to anyone who just happens to have a hobby, a language hobby. You go only for serious training, and you are sent by the government, and it must be related to government work in a language picked by the government, which is related to specific assignments. So Oswald learned Russian at the U.S. Monterey School of Languages. Another odd thing, Oswald was given an early discharge from the Marines because his mother had injured her foot. Let's call it a dependency discharge. Your parent needs you. A jar had fallen on her toe. And he was immediately, he put in the request and he got it within a week. His fellow Marines were astonished at the velocity of the release. It also so happened that the jar fell on her foot a year before the discharge. But she was having, it wasn't healing right, you know. This was only one of a number of very strangely favorable treatments that the U.S. government began to give Lee Harvey Oswald. He then defected to the USSR. But how? Philip Melanson raises the question. To get to Russia in those days, it would have cost $1,500. Lee Harvey Oswald's bank account showed a deposit of only $203. He got, after he arrived in London and was there, he left London and went to Helsinki on October 11th. On a day when there were no available commercial flights that would have allowed him to make it in one day. He had some kind of private transportation to get to Helsinki. In Russia, he announced that he was renouncing his U.S. citizenship and that he had lots of secrets that he was going to give to the Soviets. He even went into the U.S. embassy and announced that and made sure they all knew it. The Soviets didn't bite. They let him stay, but they at no time thought he could be an agent of any use to them. They kept him under constant surveillance. He worked in a factory. He showed no particular interest in guns, but he belonged to the factory's gun club. He used to join in the rabbit shoots, and he could never hit the rabbit. Always someone had to come behind him and shoot the rabbit while he was firing, otherwise they would have been there all day. It was a joke. He was a miserable marksman, as he had been in the U.S. Marines. He had been flagged again and again he missed the whole target a number of times. You get the flag. So Lee Harvey Oswald's show was couldn't hit the side of a barn. Now, if Lee Harvey Oswald was really a defector and not a U.S. spy, then U.S. intelligence could well have taken the view that his was one of the most damaging defections in history. Now, what's done in all defections, especially those connected with, definitely those connected with government and military, is that there's a damage assessment. No damage assessment was ever made on Oswald's defection. This did come out in the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee. Why was, there was no damage assessment. Guess it was just overlooked. We don't know. After 2.5 years, he applies to return to the U.S. This is after renouncing his citizenship, announcing he was going to give away secrets. And instead of being grabbed when he comes out and tried as a traitor, the U.S. accepts him back. And he says he was never debriefed. In fact, he was debriefed in Holland, in Amsterdam, but the CIA has no record of debriefing him, doesn't know who he is, never touched him, was never near him. And their explanation before the commission was that there were so many tourists coming in and out, that there was nothing particularly about him that would catch our attention. One might wonder, what is needed to catch your attention? A defector, secrets, all that. After the assassination, the CIA claimed that they suspected that he was a Soviet spy. They still didn't debrief him then. That makes it even more curious. He gets out of Russia, and what does the State Department do? They give him money. They give him money to travel back to the U.S. and get set up. They pay all his travel and moving expenses and those of his wife's. He's given back his passport with full rights to travel anywhere and denounce the U.S. government again someplace else. His wife is exempted from usual immigration quotas, no waiting, no exclusion for having belonged to the Soviet Komsomol, which is the Communist Youth Organization, which is a violation of U.S. immigration laws. Yet she was allowed in. Once back in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald settles in under the wing of one George Demorenschild, a right-wing Russian with CIA ties. And this begins a whole pattern that goes on in Dallas and New Orleans, namely the forays out into the public eye as a leftist. He starts a one-person Fair Play for Cuba organization in New Orleans, never has another member, never recruits another member. In all his time in New Orleans and in Dallas, he never once contacts a single member of the Communist Party or any other left organization. Although he writes lots of letters to the Communist Party USA and to the Socialist Workers Party, two groups which at that time weren't even talking to each other. Say, dear comrades, how are you? We fight forward and we go on. Yes, what should I do? And this and that. Send me instructions, you know. He blazes a trail, local TV, fistfights, inflammatory incidents, leaflets. One of the leaflets shows that his organization was on Camp Street in the very same building that Guy Bannister had his office. Guy Bannister was an FBI agent, and a whole bunch of other Cuban emigre right-wing groups were there. And his personal relations were with right-wing anti-communist Cubans or with right-wing crypto-fascists or CIA types or others. So while he supposedly was this leftist, and if you ever heard any of the tapes of him speaking and explaining what communism was or socialism was, it's laughable. It's this little rote, superficial thing. While he was a leftist, in fact, all his personal associations were with right-wing people linked to the intelligence community. He also knew Jack Ruby. Now, they would have us believe that this man who couldn't hit the side of the barn took a Manlinka Carcana rifle whose sights were not even set. An Italian weapon, by the way, which the Italians said, the weapon that never killed anyone on purpose. And he fired and killed the President of the United States. That he would forego shooting President Kennedy when he had a full body shot of him coming right at him down Houston Street, right toward the Texas Book Depository, where he could go at him like a shooting gallery that's coming closer and closer. Perfect, the ideal thing. He didn't shoot him then. He waited until the car turned at a 110-degree angle down Elm Street, and as he went by and had only his head and a little portion of his shoulders, and then firing through the trees, he rapidly got off 3 shots in a few seconds, something which the best marksmen in the country were not able to emulate until after much practice and after the sights on the Manlinka Carcana were reset and brought into a laboratory and fixed in there. And they had all sorts of remarks to make about the awful performance of this rifle. By the way, right through a tree that was later cut down. We are asked to believe that a bullet would go through John Kennedy, pose in midair for 2 seconds, change directions, and wound Governor Connolly in 2 places, and then reappear intact on a stretcher fallen out of Connolly's body. By the way, that's not true. It did not ever reappear on the stretcher. as if fallen out of somebody's body. It had reappeared wedged into the side of the stretcher. It obviously had been pushed in there. So this was a bullet that jumped out of Connolly's body and wedged itself in the side of the stretcher. This magic bullet had a lot of magic in it. We're asked to believe that a treasure of physical evidence, the interior of the limousine, the presidential limousine itself, which would have all sorts of evidence, bits of shrapnel, whatever else, from bullet parts, blood, lines of fire, which was just accidentally taken, instantly torn out, destroyed, and totally rebuilt, that this was not a deliberate cover-up. But we're asked to believe that Kennedy's brain just disappeared. That the x-ray, which now shows a reconstructed head with no exit wound, is oddly taken with no jaw. So it could be anybody's. You can't do any kind of dental identification to see if that x-ray is President Kennedy's. That the autopsy was just botched innocently. We're asked to believe that Jack Ruby, a gambler and gangster with links to the Cuban exiles and an acquaintance of Oswald's, who once worked for Congressman Richard Nixon for the House Un-American Activities Committee in Chicago when his name was still Jack Rubenstein, were asked to believe that he just took it upon himself to kill Oswald because he was so moved by the suffering that Oswald had caused the Kennedy family. Although Ruby, a year later in jail, repeatedly kept alluding to the fact that you don't know the whole story. There's much more behind all of this. There's something really deep and sinister here and all this. And he was just simply dismissed by a media that was taking its cues. We're asked that the 21 witnesses, persons otherwise related to the case in some close way, with some information, privy to some conversations, whatever else, all who met violent deaths were part of a colossal coincidence, like the one the Washington Post was talking about. That later on in 1978, the second round of killings that started after the House Select Committee investigation, 16 more who died violently, they just happened to die coincidentally, violent deaths, including one of them being George de Morenchild himself, killed by a gun blast to the head 3 hours after a House Assassinations Committee investigator had tried to contact him. He was being set up for an interview. He was being set up for a lot more than that. George Morenchild was not only close to Oswald, but in his telephone book there was found an inscription or an insert to George Pappy Bush, that he was a close friend of George Bush, and there was a correspondence between them. William Sullivan, third guy in the FBI, who was supposed to appear before the House committee to talk. By the way, Sullivan was on CIA, according to Robert Murrow, he was on the CIA payroll. He was shot right outside his home by a man who claimed to have mistaken him for a deer. Sam Giancano, who died from natural causes when his heart stopped beating after a bullet went through it. One day before he was to testify about mob and CIA connections, while under government protection. And by the way, what comes out of this whole thing is the incredible linkages between the CIA and mob families.
Thanks for listening. Next week, Parenti focuses on the state within the state. New World Notes comes to you from New World Notes Underground Studios of Underground Studios of WWUH, a community service of the University of Hartford. The views expressed here are entirely my own or Parenti's, not those of anyone else connected with this station. Email kdowst@hotmail.com. Thanks to Maria Gilardin, TUC Radio, and the A Infos Radio Project for making Parenti's 1993 talk available. Until next time, this is Kenneth Doust advising, remember the Maine, remember the Lusitania, remember the Liberty, remember the Reichstag fire, and remember the government-appointed 9/11 cover-up commission. And remember to tune in again next week. Ciao. I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys?